Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz here on a Friday edition of the show. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at DunbarLumber.com. We are now very pleased to have on the line from The Athletic, talking a little LA Kings with us here. He is Eric Stevens. Eric, thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm good, guys. How are you doing today up there?
Yeah, we're doing very well, and we're excited to have you on because, as I was saying earlier in the show, you know, really one of the more fascinating stories in the league right now, from my perspective, is the LA Kings. And, of course, it kind of got a lot of attention around the hockey world this week with the loss to Buffalo, with comments from Todd McClellan, from Drew Doughty. You know, were you surprised by anything you heard from either of those guys or from anyone else on the team following that loss against Buffalo?
You know what? I maybe just a touch surprised in the fact that, not only obviously were they pointed comments, very strong comments, but I think they were very necessary. You know, I being around the Kings, being, you know, for a good bit whatsoever, in general, they're sort of a button-down group. You don't really, outside of Drew Doughty or whatsoever, you don't have too many, say, you know, out there personalities or you know, extroverted personalities on that group. So I think in the sense that it was necessary, you know, it's been a bad stretch. There's no sugarcoating it. And that loss, especially when they had gotten up on Buffalo, you know, grabbed the 3-1 lead. Buffalo had played the night before. They were pretty terrible in Anaheim. You know, this was a game that they should have won and closed out. And to lose it in that manner, to play as sloppily as they did, it was very anti-King-like, at least from what you saw through the first, you know, say, 3 months of the season. But it's also just indicative of, you know, kind of the way that they're in right now and you know, what they have to do to dig themselves out of it, you know, before this the entire season really goes sideways.
Eric, how itchy is Rob Blake's trigger finger at the moment, do you think, in terms of making some changes in short order?
Well, you know, he gave the vote of confidence to Todd.
Oh,
you know,
bad sign.
Yeah, well, vote of confidence. We know how those generally go. Generally speaking, okay. So, you know, saying that, I think Rob is generally one to exercise patience, you know, with regard to major moves. Now, he's not gun shy in terms of doing them. I mean, we saw him deal Jonathan Quick last spring. A franchise icon. We obviously seen the big moves that he's made in terms of the acquisitions that he's done over the last couple of summers. So this is not a gun-shy GM, but I think in general he does exercise patience. But I think this road trip, which starts obviously tonight in Colorado, I think it's going to be really a telltale sign of whether Todd can, you know, turn the ship around and move it into a direction to where they can start, you know, just being more like themselves again, like how they showed over the first 3 months of the year. The suddenness of this toxic spill that I call it, in losing 12 or 14, I think that's really the thing that's really thrown everyone for a loop here. But you know, if they, you know, come out, say, tonight and, you know, just get boat raced by Colorado. And then you got the games, I think, too. You got St. Louis and Nashville. You know, these are two teams that the Kings should beat out. They shouldn't be they should be above them. They should be, you know, they shouldn't be in competition with them for one of the wild card spots. To me, all these three games really tell me whether Rob may have to really decide that he's got to change course. I don't think he wants to let Todd go, but we'll see if it becomes a point where he has to.
The Kings are in one of those spots, Eric, that I always find really fascinating because in terms of their underlying profile, right, they're still, even over the course of this brutal stretch, they're still controlling games more nights than not. But I sometimes worry with teams, you know, that you get to like a critical mass of dissatisfaction and failure and just kind of need to make a change just to change it up effectively. Is that sort of the risk? Is that some of what Blake would be weighing here? Is there still belief in what they've built effectively is what I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing is that what's built is what's going to be. I mean, they're capped out, you know. So what's built is what's going to be. There's not going to be it's going to be awfully difficult to make a huge deadline acquisition without subtracting from the current roster. You know, and part of that is obviously, you know, when you go in and you bring in, you know, you add salary with the Fiala last summer, then you bring in, obviously, you know, you double down on that with Dubois, or the last summer, Fiala was obviously the previous one. So this is the direction that they've built, you know, gone to and have led up to this, but they're capped out. You know, they're looking at and hoping on Victor Arvidsson being that sort of in-house trade acquisition. And if he can give them something, you know, he is on the mend. It looks like he's on a positive trend in terms of being able to return for the playoff push here. And if he can give them something that, you know, then great. They have, you know, maybe their in-house acquisition. But that's what they're limited to because of how capped out they are. So if you can't make a notable trade or a notable change that way, looking behind the bench is really the other if you've got to go that route.
You know, Eric, of course, one of the big stories with the Kings this season, the acquisition of Pierre-Luc Dubois and the lack of impact that he's had on the team, you know, both in terms of his counting stats, but I know in other areas of the game as well. You have a great piece talking to Pierre-Luc Dubois up at The Athletic right now. And I know it's a big question, maybe difficult to answer, but, you know, in your view, why hasn't it worked? Like, I'm sure both sides wanted it to when he was acquired this summer.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, at least one of the things coming out of talking to him that he does acknowledge is that he knows he was brought in to be a difference maker. And he knows that he hasn't. Okay. So, yes, you know, and this is a player who generally talks the talk. I mean, anyone that's talked to him over the years, you know, in the different teams whatsoever, he can talk the talk for sure. It's about walking the walk, you know, when it comes down to PL. I think one of the issues, he's certainly been moved around the lineup. They've tried different things, certainly. I think one of the adjustments for him has been, you know, he's been a top six player throughout his existence, you know, whether in Columbus or whether in Winnipeg. Whereas here in L.A., yes, he was brought in with maybe the future in mind in terms of, you know, the day that Andre Kopitar finally slows down or decides to hang him up whatsoever. They've got a quality center in place. But for right now, he was brought in to really deepen this lineup, to make them really fearsome in the middle when you've got Kopitar and Philip Deneau, you know, and then you slot Dubois in as your third line center. That's where he should be making a difference, theoretically. You know, he should be feasting on, you know, similar matchups, matchups that he generally faces. But, you know, it just hasn't happened. He hasn't, you know, he didn't really mesh well with Kevin Fiala when they played on a line together early on. Todd put him on the wing for a couple of games with Kopitar and Adrian Kempe. That didn't really work. He was already, you know, they abandoned that very quickly and put Quentin Byfield back up there. So in some senses that he's been, you know, PL's been a little bit adrift in that generally he's centered line mates that really haven't been real proven, you know, offensive performers at this level. But it's also on him as well. It's got to come from him as well. And too often, I think, you know, Kings fans have kind of seen what Jets fans and Blue Jackets fans have seen previously, you know, is someone who just isn't engaged all the time. It's intermittent. And as others have said, and I think he's, you know, realized himself, he's got to be able to bring it for this group. He's got to be a difference maker. He's certainly being paid like one.
Yeah, I was going to say, given the contract, and not only the contract, but the price paid to acquire him and the success that some of those players are having in Winnipeg for a really good Jets team, do you get the sense that there's any buyer's remorse from the Kings looking at the Pierre-Luc Dubois acquisition?
Yeah, I mean, from the inside, you know, it's hard to say, but from the inside.
Of course.
I don't know if it's reached that point. But from the outside, certainly it looks that way. I mean, it's right now, if you just judge it on the right now, it looks like a disastrous trade. Now, if they do reach the playoffs and he is a factor in them, say, winning a series, he can help at least kind of swing that pendulum back toward it looking like, okay, this is why we got him. This is the reason here. But it's really going to take that. It's going to take a stronger finish to the year, and him being in a factor, a difference maker in a series where they're advancing in the playoffs to change that narrative. Because right now, again, if you judge it on right now, it looks like a disastrous trade.
Are there any dads on the team that can go on the radio and call the group soft or something? Have they considered that? Worked for the Panthers last year.
You know what? I'm not. You know what? I don't know. I don't know about that. But like I said, I think it was a high time that someone like Drew said what he said.
Yeah.
Previously, yes, it's not like they've been playing so horribly during this stretch, but it's parts of the engine that were failing, and they don't have that Connor McDavid or Nate McKinnon, you know, or that player where those, when the parts are starting to fail, they can just say, all right, you know, enough of this, I'm going to do something about it. They don't have that type of guy. It's a collective with the Kings. That's why I think it was good that after that game, that it wasn't one where they were kind of shrugging it off and saying, you know, and saying the usual platitudes whatsoever. It was good for somebody like Drew with the cachet that he has and the clout that he has with that franchise to basically say, look, enough's enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, here's the other thing is what's going wrong with the Kings from a hockey perspective. I mean, there's a lot, but number one, 5-on-5 the last month, they're shooting about 6% at 5-on-5 and they're getting 900 goaltending. Going with Cam Talbot has worked on balance this season. Has their luck run out trying to patch things together in net? And is that a change we could see ahead of the deadline?
I think it's certainly something that they obviously can't rule out. Mm-hmm. They've got to look. They do have to have their eyes open and kick their tires on some netminders that are available either now or at least definitely will be available, at the deadline. Cam's not making the amount of first saves that he was making when he was playing at an all-star level. That's what was so good about his bounce back season, was he was in a system that a tight system where all he had to do was make that first save, and you've got teammates that'll clear out any rebounds that he would leave, and he was sucking up a lot of those shots. You know, he wasn't allowing many rebounds. Well, he's not making as many of those first saves, you know. And I do think that in a lot of sense that maybe he was starting to wear down some. They played him a lot. I think they maybe played him too much, quite frankly, in the first half of the season. So, you know, they gave him this little break here. David Rittich had the net for a couple of games, looked well, you know, for the most part. And maybe they're going to have to look at playing him a little bit more here and seeing if he can still recapture that big save day form after the All-Star break. But no, they should definitely not rule out looking at goaltending, and I think that there are a couple that'll be available at, you know, price points where if you do some creative roster management whatsoever, they might be able to say fit in.
Eric, really appreciate the time and the insight on the Kings. Thanks for doing this. Hopefully we can chat again soon.
Yes, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you so much.
That is Eric Stevens covering the LA Kings for The Athletic. And a really, like, it's an interesting story anyways, given how hot they started the season, given what they paid to get Pierre-Luc Dubois and how much he's struggled to make an impact there, the comments from Drew Doughty, all of that. But it's really a Canucks relevant story as well, Drancer, because as they fall into that wild card race, you know, all of a sudden it becomes a very live possibility whether the Canucks, if the Canucks win the division, whether they're first in the conference or not, LA is a very, very plausible first round opponent for the Canucks. And I guess the question now is, you know, it's easy to look at it. We were having this debate a little bit throughout the course of January, you know, who do you want the Canucks to play of the Pacific Division teams? It's easy right now to look at LA and say, well, it's clearly got to be LA, but just based on the talent they have already and the possibility that they could do something to switch things up a little bit, it's really, really hard to say what LA is going to look like by the time the playoffs roll around, right? Like, I feel like I have a very, very little handle on what to expect from that team the rest of the way and once they get on into the playoffs.
Well, I brought up the dad going on the radio and calling everyone soft for a reason.
I mean, Drew Doughty is like the team dad, I guess. Close
right.
enough.
I don't want to say it's easy. It's not guaranteed that a team with an elite underlying profile, one of the best in the league,
mm-hmm.
going through a stretch where the reason they're losing is 900 goaltending and 6% shooting, like unlucky at both ends of the rink, 5-on-5. You know, now that said, their goaltending is patchwork.
Mm-hmm.
They were getting outrageous performances from like $2 million worth. Like, they're getting what they paid for.
Well, and as Eric was saying, they have really good players.
Yes.
But they don't necessarily have the top
they
end
don't have
offensive
the guy.
Players
yeah.
that a lot of their competitors.
For sure.
So, you know, like Fiala, Kempe, great players, really good offensive players, but they're not McDavid, Pettersson, MacKinnon, etc.
And they don't play a style that lends itself to creating a ton of offense, right? Like, they play extremely narrow, disciplined North-South hockey, flat out. And yeah, they probably could use an additional creator. It's one of the reasons I thought the Dubois acquisition was going to be such a strong one for them, because he's such a good East-West playmaker. It hasn't clicked.
Yeah.
Now, this might be one of those situations where the team's goaltending is not good enough, their system is too conservative in terms of how they generate offense, they're juking the numbers, and they're not going to find a way to make their dominance of the puck game after game count sufficiently. They're not going to have enough of a pointy end.
A little bit
to
of like
attack.
Carolina Hurricane syndrome, or even like pre Bruce Cassidy Vegas Golden Knights syndrome there. You know
sure.
what I mean?
Maybe.
Not that they're perfect comparisons, but that profile of team.
But we also see this a lot where you've got a team that struggles for whatever ephemeral reason. The Florida Panthers being a great example, right? Like an elite underlying profile, nightmare year, limp into the playoffs in eighth, Keith Tkachuk calling the team soft on the radio, and then things...
Paul Maurice losing it.
Losing his mind.
Yeah.
And all of that dysfunction hides. Oh, wow, this is one of the best teams in hockey. So you don't want to overreact the other way either. My bet... I think the Kings are really good. I think they're a top five team in the league. In the league. And I think that would be a nightmare first round opponent. Although I think LA, I think Vegas would be a nightmare first round opponent.
Yes.
I think Edmonton would
certainly
be.
Certainly Edmonton.
And you know what? If I was any of those teams, I wouldn't be like, yay, the Canucks.
No.
We're going to shoot on Demko for seven games while this power play comes
out.
Yeah,
do you think the Kings, with their problems in net and finishing, want to face the red-hot finishing and red-hot goaltending Canucks? Like,
heck,
they don't. It can be a really difficult matchup from both perspectives
both teams. It's a strange – well, and the Kings profile, like, the type of team that doesn't tend to give the Canucks problems. Right?
The heavier team.
The heavier rush team, right? Yeah. Like, from a pure matchup perspective, I think Vegas is a much harder matchup for Vancouver than L.A. So that might lend itself to you. And yet, on a true talent basis, like – I think LA is really, really good. So, tough year. Just a tough year in the Pacific, I think.
Yeah, very tough year in the Pacific. For all the talk about how wide open it is. And yeah, my thing about the Kings is just, and you were kind of alluding to this with the...
It's the best argument against going all in, by the way.
That the Pacific itself is so hard.
Is that, you know, again, you think about, everyone's going to bring up 06, the Carolina Hurricanes, and they should. But what happened in 06? Because Carolina was, like, legitimately good that year. They weren't, like, a classic lucky, quote-unquote, team. But they had the 1982 Canucks thing going for them. Ottawa went out before they had to face them. And Detroit went out in the Western Conference Final. They never played either. Right? So you effectively avoided the two top true talent teams and were able to beat Dwayne Roloson's Edmonton Oilers to win the Cup. The Canucks, because of the new playoff format, just don't have that luxury.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you finish first in the West and you get like a relatively...
You're going to have to beat at least one... really good team from the Pacific, right? Because even
least.
If you get the crossover team, at least one.
Yeah, but if you get the crossover team, you might have the other team come out of the Central. Like, that's very like, you could have Vegas move over and come out. I mean, I'm just saying the Pacific itself guarantees that you're playing, in my estimation, a top five true talent team in the second round and very possibly in the first as well. And that's the best argument. There is no, in the Pacific this year, I don't think there's a realistic path to, like, having the Manchester miracle on Manchester happen, and so you get to duck the 1980s Oilers. Mm. Like, I don't think there's a realistic path to avoiding Ottawa and avoiding Detroit on your run to the final.
We have an open segment coming up next here. Of course, Dimitri will join us at 1:30. So if you have any ideas for what we should draft, hit us up. Let us know. We're always open for ideas a half hour before we start a segment. But open segment coming up next here on a Friday afternoon. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So if you have questions, hit us up to the Dunbar Lumber text line. We will do our best to answer them. Lots more Canucks talk coming up here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Friday edition of the show here on Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk, brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dmitry Filipovich will join us at 1:30 today to wrap up the week here on Canucks Talk, as he usually does. Lots of suggestions coming in for potential drafts with Dmitry. Someone said, obviously a charcuterie draft. Get specific. LOL. I like that.
And anytime touchdown scorers for conference for championship weekend.
I like that. Mac in North Van says, you guys should draft teams most likely to miss the playoffs, not including the bottom six teams. So, like, bubble teams most likely to miss the playoffs.
I like that. That's
interesting. I like that. We assigned homework to producer Lena. We were like, hey, we did a Super Bowl team draft at some point. Go back and listen and see who we all took. And she's like, I don't think you guys did do that draft. I've listened to like 6 weeks worth of them and can't find it. So
maybe we
just had a fever dream of doing that. But we'll see. We'll see if we can turn it up. I did want to read this one. There's some other good texts coming in here. But I want to read this one from devoted listener and texter Austin and Langley. And Austin Langley says, what segment is the Erickson Ek update today? See him mixing it up in the Preds Wild game at the end? That's playoff hockey. He's ready for a deep Canucks run. The only reason I bring this up is that Austin Langley is part of a contingent of Canucks Twitter who's trying to, like, manifest making Joel Erickson Ek to the Canucks rumors a real thing. And he frequently texts in the show, and I've even sometimes, like, read other portions of his text but then excised the Erickson Ek portion of it. So I wanted to just acknowledge the effort from Austin and Langley and read the Erickson Ek text today.
Be a great fit.
Be a really good fit. It's just not happening.
He, you know what? He is the perfect center for Connor Garland. Like, you couldn't design in a lab a perfect center to play with, a more perfect center to play with Connor Garland. Incredible stuff.
I will also say, you know, the way I've put it a lot is the Canucks need to find the next JT Miller trade. And when you look at the years he has left and on the number he has left, given where the cap is now, like, it's kind of, that would be it. It's just, there's no reason to think that he's going to be available. But yes, he would be an incredible, incredible fit. Okay, a couple texts came in here that I thought were interesting. Very similar, touch on similar questions. Brad and Langley texts in, says, though Garland's counting stats are still not that high, do we think his play has at least turned him into a positive trade asset? And if he has, do we think he gets moved for cap space in the summer and hope that Hoglander can fill his role next season? Ian in Vancouver texts in, hey guys, is this current Brock Besser for real, or would you consider trading him while the iron is hot? Remember last season, we would have had to add sweeteners to move on from him. That's from Ian in Vancouver.
Oh, that, or retain a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because that, I mean, remember, Ben Hankinson had permission to go try and facilitate Besser trades for months. So we actually have, like, an uncommonly good sense of his trade value a year ago, a decent snapshot of it, given how mature and multifaceted those efforts were. And like, we know that the reason it never happened was that teams wanted the Canucks to retain more than they were willing to. So, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one. Garland, I think Garland's trade value might be a little higher.
Mm-hmm.
But don't ignore that the fundamental dynamic behind Garland having, quote unquote, not positive value or negative value. I don't think he ever negative value, but, like, not the sort of value commensurate with his actual quality as a player.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you had Raheem Mostert in fantasy football. RB2, but no one wanted to trade for him because everyone thought
skeptical
Devon Achane was going to take over and also that he was going to get hurt. You know, like that type of guy. The thing is that there are teams that will think we can't pay $5 million for a guy who we don't think is more than like a 45-point guy. Mm-hmm. A guy who we don't think is ever going to score 20 for us.
That you're ever going to feel like really good about having in your top six, as opposed to being a plus third line.
Or in a matchup. You know what I mean? Yeah. Right? So he'd be sort of viewed as like appropriately priced, maybe a luxury item by a lot of teams. On the other hand, his performance has been so good that if you're one of those teams that's maybe a little more progressive, maybe a little more data driven, maybe a little less concerned with size, you'd be like, proof of concept. We've seen it. My goodness, look at what he's doing. This is a top-line player. Those teams might be willing to pay something to get him. So, but those teams are also aware that, you know, we probably like this guy more than most.
Right.
So hard to get a retail price when a player is as polarizing from an evaluation perspective as Garland is around the league.
I think the question is, the two questions, right, about Besser's potential trade value and Garland's potential trade value are really interesting, though, because
Neither's getting moved now.
No. This would be a summer, and one of them even says a summer thing. But I just think it illustrates, like, we're so used to going into the offseason or going into a trade deadline and talking about how difficult anything is going to be for the Canucks because of the reduced value of their players, the salary cap situation, all of these things, right? Like, how long do we talk about, hey, it's going to be really hard to dismantle this roster? Because of the performance of this team and because of, you know, a lot of the salary cap space opening up this summer, there's two ways you can look at this. Like, on the one hand, there's a lot of uncertainty going into the summer, but that uncertainty always comes with opportunity and possibility as well, right? And I think because players like Besser and Garland are playing so much better and are contributing to a team that's at the top of the standings and are going to have a chance to go do something in the playoffs, you're entering this situation now where for the first time in a long time, the stars are kind of aligning that the Canucks are going to be able to do a lot of different things this summer if they so choose. Like, there's going to be so many more options on the table depending on how things break than we're used to. Normally, it's like, well, maybe they could try to move Garland, but you'd probably have to pay. And like, do you really want to retain? And so, well, if they don't do that, are they going to, you know, are they going to have the cap space to really do anything meaningful in UFA? When you look at everything that's going to be on the table for the Canucks this year, I think it's going to be radically, radically different than that. And I'm not saying they should therefore trade Garland or trade Besser. But my point is, I think you're going to have a lot more options to sort through. And, all, you know, of course, a lot of it will depend on what happens with Pettersson and Hronek, how the season ends and all of that. But I just think it illustrates, like, how much more flexibility this team is going to have going into the offseason this year.
Yeah, and the Besser one's interesting because he becomes extension eligible on July 1. So, you know, it's not as straightforward as your usual situation. Like, you probably do want to at least begin to feel out what a decision looks like.
Mm-hmm.
On keeping him long term versus, you know, potentially reallocating that cap space. And I guess where we, you know, to sort of twist this conversation, because this team's playing so well.
I know, I don't want to get too far into the what are they going to do in the summer stuff, but I thought it was an interesting, the two questions came in to kind of put that out there.
Yeah, and I also don't think, like, this team has an opportunity to do something special, so I'm reluctant to, you know, put that like, not bad juju, just like,
It's putting the cart before the horse.
The idea of uncertain futures, like, the only uncertain future we should be focused on here is what can the Canucks win the Pacific? Can they win the West? Can they win the President's Trophy? Can they win the Cup? Like, that's it. Can they go on a deep run? Can they win the Cup? Let's go the full step-by-step up the pyramid. Where there will be some difficulty here is if the Canucks are going to swing for the fences, right? If they want to upgrade their roster, they are limited by, you know, having to make dollar in, dollar out deals for the most part. Right now, I think you could make a few deals. Like, I think you could add a bit of salary by just reassigning
players.
Like you reassign Mark Friedman, you reassign Phil DiGiuseppe when he's healthy. You know, you can open up a little bit of cap space. Like, we're talking about, I don't know, like $1.5 million, something like that. $1.5 million add without subtracting from this roster. But with the names that we're throwing out here and that our listeners are interested in talking about, including Joel Eriksson Ek, you know, we're talking about a lot more than $1.5 million, right? Like, we're talking about a team that's going to need to find a way to clear some meaningful space, you know, if they want to do the sort of big stuff, right? The bigger line items that we've been hearing about, talking about, thinking about here. So, you know, I mean, yeah, so roughly, yeah, you could add about $1 million. It's tough. So what comes next is really, for me anyway, leading up to the deadline, about cap reallocation and how the Canucks, if they go shopping for a Gensel, Henrik type, Elias Lindholm type, how they reallocate. And I think we all just kind of take it for granted, right? That, like, it's Kuzmenko. Right?
I don't think it's unfair.
No. It's not.
You know what I mean? Maybe taking it for granted is too strong, but, like, if you're going to power rank opportunities to clear that salary cap space, he's number one with a bullet for a lot of good reasons.
I don't even know if there's a number two.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's, like, hard to think of who the second player would be who would make sense in that spot.
You know? I mean, I think you'd have to go with things like maybe they just rented Zadorov.
Yeah.
You know, but like,
yeah.
I don't know.
But I don't know. That doesn't seem particularly plausible. It doesn't seem completely unrealistic, but I don't know. Like, there's no reason to think that. Whereas I think there is plenty of valid reason to think that they could do that with Kuzmenko.
Yeah. I mean, among current Canucks players who've played at least 20 games, Kuzmenko ranks 11th by ice time per game, 5-on-5. Like, it's hard to escape the gap in usage, cap hit in discussing it, but reallocating Kuzmenko might not be straightforward. Like, if Gensel shakes loose, would the Penguins have interest in Kuzmenko? Like, you know, I'm not sure.
I think you almost have to look at it as two separate transactions.
Right. So you're looking at a Beauvillier-style, Beauvillier out, Zadorov in, two separate deals?
Yeah, I think that's what makes the most sense. Not that it would be impossible to include him in wherever you're getting the impact player from.
No.
Like, especially if maybe it was the Ducks with Henrik or something and they're not as concerned about the salary.
But that's not easy, right?
Yeah.
Like, even that's not easy. So then you're looking at trying to net value for Kuzmenko, and then ideally shop some of that value? Mm-hmm. Like, hopefully you get enough of a return, but would you? Would you get enough of a return?
No, I almost think... I don't know if he's a negative value player at this point, but I think you're really just factoring it in as... Let's say you did have to give something up to move Kuzmenko. I'm not saying you necessarily would, but you just factor that in as part of the price you're paying for the player that you're acquiring, right? That's just what it is at this point. And even, like, to me, it's almost, yeah, obviously you don't want to give away a player. You don't want to pay if you don't have to, but the return you're getting for Kuzmenko is the cap space. That's it, right? And any other asset you get back is completely secondary to getting the cap space to go out and make another move.
Do you think he has as much value as a first-round pick?
No. No, clearly not.
Second-round pick?
Probably not. Do you?
No, probably not. I think you're right.
Yeah, I don't think so. But, like, again, I'm okay with that because it opens up the space for you to do something else.
Yeah.
And that's the real value of doing that deal.
Yeah.
Especially if you're clearing the full salary, right? Then you're fine not getting that much of a return, I think, anyways.
It's more complicated than it seems, right? Like,
sure.
Now, I know that Alvin and Rutherford have found ways to wheel and deal even in a flat cap environment and at a really impressive clip, but you know that this is another, the Canucks want to be all in, but actually getting there, actually being all in, is going to require some serious dexterity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think dexterity that they've earned, you know, they've earned our benefit of the doubt. Like, we should be able to trust that they can navigate as well as anyone else through these choppy flat cap waters, but man, it is not straightforward.
It's going to be difficult, but I don't think it's impossible by any
means.
You know what I mean? And you're not saying that, but I think even Kuzmenko, the fact that he only has the 1 year left, to me puts him in such a different category than some other bloated contracts around the league, right? Or inefficient deals. Because yeah, look, teams are so reluctant even to take that one extra year, but it's still only one extra year. And there are teams where it would not be crushing to have to absorb that salary. So I think it's more doable than sometimes it is to, you know, the idea of trading an inefficient contract. But you're right. It's not going to be as easy as just, hey, we're going to go get a second round pick for Kuzmenko and then flip that for another player, right? It's going to be more difficult than that.
Yeah, like, especially some of these, especially a team like a Pittsburgh-type seller, right, where they're not going to waive. If they move on from Gensel, it's not a white flag on next season, you know? Maybe the Ducks would see some value in adding a scoring winger, you know, I guess. But, like, would the Flames? Like, would the Flames really have any interest in that?
No, I don't know. That's why I think it would be trade them first, then do the next move.
It's just that's sort of, so if that's the case, then when we're talking about these targets, it's really step two, you know?
100%.
We're talking about a two-step move, and it's not as simple as Canucks add guy, right? Canucks subtract and then add. And maybe there's a benefit in that. Maybe there's like a hybrid approach to the trade deadline that actually can be helpful, especially if you can net a meaningful asset of any kind for Kuzmenko.
Speaking of, you know, who would be number two on the power rankings of guys to move out to clear salary to potentially open up for an impact acquisition, this text didn't come in response to that that question, but it is a name that has come in. So he says, Canucks talk, is Ilya Mikheyev really playing in a way that is deserving of so much criticism on Canucks Twitter? His scoring has cooled lately, but he already has 10 goals for the season. Solid member of the Canucks much improved PK. It seems that the Canucks market needs a scapegoat every season. And yeah, Mikheyev.
Is Mikheyev a scapegoat? Have we reached that point in the discourse?
But he's definitely, I have noticed over the last month or so, a lot more criticism directed at Ilya Mikheyev. And, you know, I think this is a situation where
this guy has exceeded all reasonable expectations by such a wide margin this season. Like, if he'd come back and looked two steps slower and actually struggled, not like fake struggled because he wasn't scoring over the course of a 10-game point streak for the team, I still would have been like, man, he's coming off of major ACL surgery. Like, it might take him a full year to get back to who he was. This is a speed-reliant player. He's looked fast. He's been defensively reliable. He's been good when called on the PK, and probably could do more in that area, in my view. You know, when the Canucks moved Pettersson up to play with Besser and Miller, that line played really well, and Mikheyev was a big part of it. You know, for large swaths of the season, he's led the team in 5-on-5 goals. You know, he led the entire NHL in shooting percentage, on-ice shooting percentage last year. It was like 13.5%.
Mm-hmm.
He's down at a still very high 11.5% 5% now, and that's enough to get him on the GOAT list? Like, I don't know. I think Ilya Mikheyev's been a really, really good piece for this team. I think he's performed, despite probably never being in a state where we could assume that he's 100%, he's been like a valuable two-way contributor. He's scored way more than I think you could have reasonably expected when the Canucks signed him. Like, I think this has hit to the 99th percentile, and I think he might be even better next season, given, you know, that he'll then be 18 months removed from a very serious surgical procedure. No, I'm not buying it. Mikheyev's good. Mikheyev's played well. Mikheyev's playing well actively right now.
And the thing for me is, even when he is in a scoring slump, and by the way, you know, he's still over half a point per game
also
this season, right? With not much power play time.
Yeah.
And has played a lot with Elias Pettersson, to be fair, but has also played other spots in the lineup and is still producing at a totally reasonable rate. I think the frustration, the reason why it cropped up is once Andrei Kuzmenko wasn't having the same chemistry with Elias Pettersson, I think all of a sudden there was, you know, and then there was Sam Lafferty playing up with them, right? And all of a sudden it's Ilya Mikheyev is the second most skilled guy on your top line. And that's just a role he's not supposed to be in, right? That's not the role that Ilya Mikheyev is going to play on your winning hockey team. And so I think whenever that happens and a guy gets thrust into a role that maybe is not the right role for him, sometimes you see this frustration from fans. But the thing that's never, the reason why I have never been super concerned about Ilya Mikheyev is he still has a role on the team, right? And you've seen that trust and you've seen him retain that role. So even if he isn't scoring, even if his scoring drops off, even if he goes through, you know, a slump in terms of finishing, you still think he can help you defensively. You still think that the coach is going to trust him and going to trust him to do all these different things. That's always been the concern with Kuzmenko. And there's a reason why Kuzmenko's lack of scoring is much more troubling to me than Ilya Mikheyev going through a cold slump. It's because Mikheyev can still help you. You know how Mikheyev can help you once you get to the playoffs.
Here's my concern, though, Jamie, with Mikheyev. Is if this is viewed as a scoring slump for Ilya Mikheyev, then if that's where the expectations are set, then we may well be in for a lot more of this discourse over the balance of his contract, right? Like, this is a player who, when the Canucks had signed him, right, in three previous NHL seasons, all of which he'd been very good in, he had converted on 8.4% of his 5-on-5 shots, 284 shots. On the 159 shots he's taken 5-on-5 for the Canucks, he's converted at 14%. So almost doubled his shooting clip, right? If you look at the on-ice stuff, it's a pretty similar story, right? Like, this is a guy who in Toronto, 9%, 6.7%, 8% on-ice shooting, 14% last season and 11.5% this season. Like, this guy, over the course of his last 90 games as a Canuck now, has been piping red hot. And his next 90 games shouldn't be expected to look that good. Like, you shouldn't be counting on, and you can't count on, getting, you know, a 5-on-5 goal every four games from Ilya Mikheyev, 23 goals in his 90 Canucks games to his career. Like, that's a good clip. That's a 20-goal scorer. I don't know that he's a consistent 20-goal scorer. I don't think that's who he is. So, I you know, if he's been below expectations now, I do think it's worth gut-checking those expectations and remembering not to conflate scoring totals with impact when you're evaluating a guy like Mikheyev. He does a lot more than just produce.
And that's why I think his speed still being there has been huge, right? Because that gives him the ability to contribute in those other ways. It reminds me a little bit, honestly, of the Connor Garland discourse. And obviously very different players, and they're going to help you in very different ways. But one of the reasons I was not, you know, pounding the table to trade Connor Garland this summer is that I could always see the role he could be successful in, right? It's exactly what he's doing right now. Third line offensive play driver for you. That's whether he was having a hot shooting season or whether he's having a poor shooting season. He's been playing in that role. And I think with Ilya Mikheyev, it's similar. He can help you by being an effective two-way forward. Now, at some point, do you have to have a conversation about salary and efficiency? If other things happen, sure, maybe that could be the case with any player, but it's not as if you're you have to look for spots to hide him in the lineup. Or like, oh boy, what is this guy going to do? What is he going to bring to the table? He's still brings things to the table on a regular basis.
Size, defensive ability, speed.
Can help on the PK. All of those things.
Yeah, and the last thing is this 12-game scoring streak does coincide with a significant drop in the quality of his line mates. Right? Like he was playing with Pettersson, then he wasn't. So that's the other thing to note here. You know, I don't think anyone should be confused about whether Mikheyev's like an offensive driver, right?
Yeah.
So
I'd still love to see him, if they do and they broke up the lotto line, I'd still love to see him with JT Miller and Brock Besser to help in match. If that's going to be a matchup minutes line going into the playoffs, I think they could use that help on the left wing.
I definitely think he could help drive play.
Yeah.
Right? I think he could help them have more of the puck, right? High-end Phil DiGiuseppe. That would be the template, right? That makes sense to me.
Rick
Tockett's
ears just perked up. Better Phil DiGiuseppe?
Oh, boy. How have I been ignoring that puzzle piece? No, I don't think he's been ignoring it.
No,
he
hasn't at all. He's been on top six. Has he been out of the top six once this year?
No.
No.
And I think he's been, you know, tasked with helping Pettersson, right, who generally is getting less help than Miller in terms of fewer minutes with Hughes, right? No Brock Besser to play with at 5-on-5. So, I mean, I think Mikheyev's usage is fine. His performance is fine. He hasn't been at his best from a scoring standpoint, but I also think we need to check our expectations. A lot of what he's produced in his Canucks career to this point was probably a little overheated.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, you look at the other scoring talent that they have in this team, and look, obviously you can always use more scoring, right? But you're not paying him to be one of your three highest scoring forwards. You're paying him to do other things, and I think he's still doing those things for the team. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. What are we gonna draft here? Is it gonna be hockey? Is it gonna be nonsense? You think about it.
I will.
All right, Trance, we'll decide. We will bring Dimitri on.
Things it would be funny to be afraid of on the Maury show.
Well, we know it's going number one because we have proof of concept, green olives. That would also work in the charcuterie draft.
Bring in the olives.
All right. It is truly Friday. Dmitry Filipovich up next here at Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. What's up? Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650, final segment of the week here on the show. We are live from the Kintech studio, as always. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. And now joining us in his customary time slot here on the show from the Hockey BDO cast, which you can hear across the Sportsnet Radio Network, it is Dmitry Filipovich. What's up, man?
Fellas, happy Friday.
Happy Friday. I was humming the saxophone Squirtle song to myself just before you came.
There you go. That should be my intro music for the show.
I actually think we might have to integrate it.
Is it rights free?
Probably not.
No.
We could use maybe a little snippet of it. Maybe we should just get some like jamming rights free saxophone music to bring to
maybe we get Dom to sing it.
Oh.
Ooh, there we go.
There we go.
Oh, man. Now I'm in the mood.
Can we just do this for 30 minutes?
Yeah.
Can we just have it play in the background while we talk the whole time? Or would that be a real rights problem?
I think that would be a rights problem in a big way. But it sounds great. Oh, I love it.
Such fun.
So good. Anyways, we'll have to do a little bit of a different segment because the Canucks only have one opponent. And
right.
It's not even an interesting one before the All-Star break. It's the Columbus Blue Jackets.
That's right.
Tomorrow. But before we get to our draft, a few things happening around the league that I did want to get into with you. We were talking earlier with Eric Stevens from The Athletic about the LA Kings, their problems. Now, Drance is making the point, which is very fair, but they're still controlling play in a lot of their games despite the brutal win-loss record as of late. How concerned are you about the LA Kings and what's happened to their win-loss record recently?
I can't say I'm too concerned because Jantz is right. Like, a lot of the underlying elements that I think make them such an effective regular season team, at least, are still there. One of my concerns about them vaulting into that, like, inner circle of Stanley Cup contenders was the offensive creativity or lack thereof. And I think we're seeing what happens with that sometimes, where you go through these stretches where you can get a lot of shots but just not create goals. Now, at the same time, they're controlling play so much that they're just going to win more games. Like, this is obviously a stretch that's similar to what Edmonton had in the start of the year.
Thank you. That's exactly it. And I was bringing up the Panthers analogy. We had Eric Stevens on the show, and I said, is there a dad on the Kings who can go on the radio and call the team soft? Like,
yeah, it's Drew Doughty.
that was what he said. Anyway, the I honestly just see a parallel there where it's like, yeah, they're goaltending soft, but I think there's enough talent there that even if the vibes feel bad over a stretch where they have 900 goaltending and 6% on ice shooting 5-on-5 for a month, I still think they're going to be a serious threat come playoff time.
Yeah, they've got the depth. I mean, obviously, what you're seeing from Pierre-Luc Dubois so far in terms of, like, early returns and stuff, that's alarming, right? And I think it can, like, spiral pretty quickly, and it has, you could argue. But at the same time, like, they're just going to – if they keep playing this way, they have too many good players. Victor Arvidsson is coming back soon, I think. Like, they're going to get it together. But whether the damage has already been done in terms of where they're going to finish in the standings is an interesting conversation, right? Because they went from feeling like, all right, they could actually push the Canucks for first in the West and first in the Pacific, to all of a sudden now, I don't know, like, Edmonton's pretty clearly head and shoulders above them, and Vegas is too, right? So they're kind of locked into that first wild card at best.
Yeah, I think they're going to have a really tough time finishing in the top three in the Pacific, which brings us to another question as we look well past the Columbus Blue Jackets. The Pacific Division, I can't escape the feeling or the sense that there's not going to be an easy path through this playoff for anybody.
Well, like,
I think there's no hiding.
No, I think there is.
Okay,
it's finishing first in the West,
right?
Yeah, because then round one is most likely going to be one of Nashville, Arizona, Seattle, St. Louis, like, it's whoever gets that second wild card, and I think.
I think St. Louis is not the ideal matchup for the Canucks, man.
Oh, they're not very good.
They're not very good.
It represents a massive drop-off from the Kings as the first wild card, I think.
Yes, agreed.
And then, in that scenario, it would be you win that round two, you have home ice against whoever survives what will probably be a seven-game series of Edmonton-Vegas again.
Yeah.
And that's not the worst spot to be in. So, I think that's the path.
That's your best case scenario, because no matter what, you're going through probably one of Vegas or Edmonton, if not, and then maybe LA if you finish, as you say, second in the West. So that's a brutally difficult thing. But at least if you delay meeting one of those teams until the second round, I mean, you increase your chances. As you said, maybe they really, you know, knock the snot out of each other in the first round as well. Okay, Edmonton, 12 points back of the Canucks right now, but with four games in hand, winners of 15 in a row.
Right.
What off the top of your head here? What chance do they have to catch the Canucks in the Pacific Division before the end of the year?
What did you say? They're
12 games back. Or sorry, 12 points back.
Yeah, with four games in hand. Right?
With four games in hand.
And only one more head-to-head? Yeah, the Canucks already... See, the Canucks banked those three.
Yeah, that was huge.
Wins against them. I don't know. It's going to be tough, man, because they've gone 25-6, I believe, since the coaching change, and they've made up 4 points on the Canucks in that time. Like, it's just really tough. The games in hand are obviously going to be very helpful, but it's just really tough to make up that type of ground.
Especially when we keep winning.
Yeah, of course, right? And
so, Canucks are on their own 10-game point streak. I mean,
yeah,
like, over the course of this win streak, they've gained 4 points on the Canucks. It's ludicrous.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'd rate it as pretty low. I mean, obviously, if they keep... Like, they're going to eventually start losing
some
games,
What do you mean by pretty low? Like, 33%?
I'd hand you that Camp the Canucks is a heavy favorite.
Yeah, but, like, right? 66%? Like, plus 400?
Sure, I mean, you're the odds maker of the bunch. I don't know.
Yeah, it's demanding that you translate into gambling odds.
I don't know. I'm sure there is a line for this, right?
Like, yeah,
Pacific Division winner.
Well, there's Pacific Division winner, but that's different than
because it also factors in
Vegas and
right. But it's I mean I sort of back of the napkin go one in three shot.
That seems reasonable.
You think that's high or low?
I don't know, man. Why are you demanding this so much? It's way too late in the week for you to be pulling this stunt on me right now.
What are you, scared, Dimitri? Yeah. Huh?
Are you ducking that question?
Pick a side. What do you have to hide, Dim? Are you some kind of coward or something coming on this show? Oh, boy. Go ahead.
I want to pivot to deadline stuff. So I've got a column up at The Athletic with Harmon Dial, what a perfect Canucks trade deadline would look like. Mm-hmm. And in it, we spend a lot of time dwelling on that the ideal Canucks target, as everyone's focused on Henrique and Elias Lindholm and Jake Guentzel, isn't a rental piece, right? That if you're going to pay retail price at the deadline anyway, trying to find like a sequel to the Filip Hronek trade is like ideally what you're looking for. And, you know, you think about the best deadline deals of the last 3-4 years. You think Coleman Gaudreau, you think Matthias Ekholm, Jake McCabe, Ivan Barbashev, who they re-signed, Nick Paul, who they re-signed, you know, Arturi Lehkonen.
Mm-hmm.
How conscious of adding a multi-year piece do you think the Canucks should be, hypothetically, like as a priority going into this deadline?
I think very, not only from the perspective of it being a player with like legitimate substance that can significantly improve this team in like very tangible ways, but also I think if you can get a player for multiple years that's under a net positive cap hit, right below their market value, that helps a lot approaching an offseason where you have so many unknowns in terms of unrestricted free agents, RFAs they have to sign, like contractual stuff that you don't know how it's going to go, right? And so in that case, just adding a player that you can lock in at that set price that's below market value, I think is huge for a team, any team really, but especially one in the Canucks position.
We, you know, the Filip Hronek one is interesting because, of course, they acquired him a year out, but he was an RFA right after this season. And the thing I find fascinating about that is so often potential RFAs see their values reduced a little bit because teams are scared of the contractual snafu. But I wonder, in the Canucks situation, if that's the kind of opportunity you can take advantage of, right? Because if you're going all in on this year, you know, that's almost kind of threading the needle between buying a true rental and having term. It's like, well, look, maybe it works out and we sign the player. Maybe we don't. Then we can get out of the money. But
Jamie's asking about Casey Middlestat.
I'm asking about Casey Middlestat, basically.
Yeah. But I was wondering where you're going
with that. Just philosophically, like, hey, if you can find that player that other teams are maybe a little wary of because they're an RFA, does that actually represent an inefficiency the Canucks could exploit?
Yeah.
And I also mean, Casey Middlestat.
I'm a big Casey Middlestat guy. I would love that. He's got a very interesting skill set. Like I think there's going to be teams like the Jets, for example, that should be all in for him because he's exactly what they need. Whereas for the Canucks, I don't think they should be getting in the business of like getting into an arms race for just that one type of player, because I think there's many different routes they could go, right? Whereas I think the Jets and both the Avalanche are in such clear need of a playmaking second line center that if the Sabres make Casey Middlestat available, I think his price might shock people for like how much they're able to fetch for him in terms of acquisition costs.
We were talking about this earlier in the show because there was the report from Emily Kaplan at ESPN today saying, you know, talking to people around the league, there's not necessarily a clear list of teams that are going to go all in. Vancouver comes up a lot, but other than that, people aren't really sure. Outside of the Canucks, who do you look at this year and say, that's a team that really should be willing to put a ton of assets on the board to get better before the deadline?
Yeah. I mean, we're talking a lot about how it's pretty wide open. At the same time, I think we all agree that, and we've talked about this in previous weeks, the West is just far superior to the East right now, especially up top. So it's tricky for these teams to talk themselves into being that open. I think the Jets are one of those teams.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they've had a miserable couple years. They're trying to win back their fans, essentially, and get them to commit financially to, like, supporting the team. And they have a good squad, and so it makes sense. But they're similarly shopping for a player with, like, some sort of either term or team, like, security in terms of being able to retain them beyond just a rental.
Stuck in Winnipeg.
Pretty much, yeah. And so in that case...
The old trap.
Yeah, the old trap. Trick. I mean, Casey Middlestat is from, I think he's from, like, Minnesota or something, right? He probably wouldn't mind staying there, but...
At least he can drive home in the summer.
Yeah. But...
doesn't have to use the Winnipeg airport.
Yeah, that's a good selling point.
doesn't have to use the Winnipeg airport.
Yeah. Yeah, anyone that lives within driving distance of Winnipeg is a good get for them.
Good target.
Canucks targets. Okay, so
are we doing this as the draft?
No. We're gonna.
Well,
draft.
I want to give you my.
Well, we can't
picks.
Talk about it before we do the draft.
Yeah, I don't want to give you my picks away. Like,
okay, well then let's just start the draft. I didn't realize right, we used the draft as a discussion point. I thought it was like a.
It's
easy
usually
way
nonsense
to get to
at
the
end.
Yeah.
What do you mean? What are you talking about?
Spoken like someone who loses every draft.
What did you think we were gonna do?
I thought we were just gonna draft.
Yeah, but okay. We can't.
Well, let's draft, and then we can maybe go a bit long and actually expand on the draft as opposed to just rushing it at the end.
Right, I appreciate that.
We're like all scrambling right. To make our final picks.
Yeah. Just saying, we don't have to go into the draft right now, but we can't talk about the draft topic and then do
yes.
The draft.
Okay, I understand.
It has to all be wrapped up into one.
I understand your objection now. I mean, I think you're being a little saxophone squirtle about it. Like,
wait,
a little
awesome?
Well, most of our drafts... Most of our drafts, the conclusion of them is Jamie frantically
yes,
looking at the clock
being like,
with producers
up,
yelling in his ears yeah. While I try to like make one final pick.
That's true.
So let's actually
stretch
it out.
All right. So we're going to draft Canucks deadline targets.
Yes.
Specific players, right, that they should target in order of, you know, biggest impact to least or whatever.
Right.
Biggest impact to least, I would say. And, I mean, let's keep it
theoretically available.
Yeah, theoretically available. Right. So not like, you know, Nathan McKinnon, right? Like you know, guys who could theoretically be on the move.
Number one pick, Connor
McDavid.
Tom just scratched him off his list. Yeah. I'm looking at his computer right now.
Furiously erasing on his notepad. All right, who wants to go first? Here.
Tom, you should go first, buddy.
You want me to go first?
Yeah. Let's give you a chance to actually win this draft.
Okay. I'm going to steal your pick then. Is that okay?
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, buddy.
It's your show.
I want the Canucks to go get a player who matches the following description. Okay? Signed. With term. Drives play in the top six.
Mm-hmm.
Fast. Tough. Cool as hell. That's my criteria.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a good player.
There is a player on a team that has far outperformed expectations this season, and yet we know will look to the future. They've got a 26-year-old winger on the books at a $5.5 million cap hit that is an exact match for Andrei Kuzmenko's.
Mm.
He is signed this year and next. He's a super pest. He's from London, Ontario. He's related to a former Canucks captain. He's Travis Konecny. Travis Konecny, number one.
Yep.
If now. I could bring one guy to Vancouver for this playoff run, and next, Travis Konecny is the guy.
I like it. I love the player. The only thing I'll say is, and this is news from today, on the Merrick Show, Elliot Friedman, of course, they did the Tippett deal,
mm-hmm.
Talking about other extensions, and Friedman didn't report that it was going to happen, but...
They want to keep
Konecny. Intimated. I wonder, right. You know, the kind of the classic Friedge. I wonder if Konecny is going to get an extension here at some point.
He should. He's really good.
So, but I agree with you. If he's on the market.
Well, this is perfect. If they're having exploratory talks ahead of Konecny's extension eligibility on July 1, now's the time to come in with a big offer.
And they've already said that they're, like, as good as the season's been, we're not going to fall in love with any players and we're going to look to the future. Like, I think they've literally said that publicly.
Now's the time.
Except so. Travis Konecny.
Pry him loose.
We're in love with him.
Well, yeah. If they're getting multiple firsts or equivalents to it, all of a sudden I think they might
That's what I'm saying.
Open their minds.
He's the guy you pay for.
Yeah. He will instantly become Rick Tocchet's favorite player on the team. He's an elite penalty killer who's going to score 40 goals this season. Dominates. Plays relentlessly. Like, I can't think of a better player in a lab for exactly what this team needs, and imagine him on Elias Pettersson's wing.
Travis Konecny.
Yeah.
Pick number one.
Yeah.
It's a good pick. It's a good pick.
You want to go second, Jamie?
Yeah, sure. I'll go second.
We're going to hose Dimitri here.
No, whatever. You get the turn. It's great. I'll go Jake Guentzel. He's a stud. I know he's a UFA. He's a winger, so he's not a center, but he's so good. He's such a playoff performer. I think he would be an incredible fit alongside Elias Pettersson. They're desperate for that other legit high-end top six player. And best of all is there. I do think there's a legitimate, I'm not saying it's a guarantee that he's going to move, but given how Pittsburgh's season has gone and kind of the weird mandate there, I do think there's a legitimate chance that he's on the board. Dubas and Rutherford have done plenty of deals, you know, going back to Dubas's time in Toronto. I don't know. I just love the player, the playoff track record, all of it, the fit. Jake Guentzel, my number two pick.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. Okay. So I got two picks here, right?
Yeah.
I'll go Pavel Buchnevich.
Love that.
Similar to exactly what you said about Konechny, I believe, maybe makes a bit more, but also on the books for next year as well.
5.8.
Essentially,
this year next.
Yeah. Essentially fit him into exactly everything Tom said about Konechny. And then give me Chris Tanev.
Chris Tanev?
Yeah.
I love it.
Chris Tanev. As help their penalty kill and also give them the luxury of potentially splitting up Hronek and Hughes and giving them a much more viable second pair.
That's a good one. I mean, it's complicated with the blue line, but I think you're right. The allure of Tanev is maybe a little too much. I'm going to go with Adam Henrique for my second pick. We've talked a lot about him on the show recently. I know Friedman mentioned his name in connection with the Canucks today on 32 Thoughts as well. And I'm putting him here, even though I love the Lindholm fit, just because I think the acquisition cost would be a lot less than Elias Lindholm. And I don't know how much the gap is at this point between them as players. And I just really like, I really like him as a player. And again, the flexibility, ability to play him down the middle, all of that, I think he'd be a good fit too.
And I know they really want to, like, Tom, I think in your list of trade deadline targets or whatever, you had one of the things being like another centerman to help with draws, right? So he would help with that. I think it's a bit of a trap though.
Henrique?
Ooh, it is.
Agreed.
Yeah. Because he doesn't really do anything. And
is that
and,
bad?
Well, it's bad. No,
it's fine.
He needs to be supported by the perfect wingers. And in reality, he has actually played wing mostly in Anaheim the past couple of years, despite taking a lot of draws. Mm. So, like, he would be a good fit for the Canucks with their bottom six wingers right now. Like, if you replaced Nils Åman, like, if you put him with guys like Höglander, or even replace Bluger and put him with Joshua Garland. And Garland, but that's already working. Yep. Like, I don't think putting him on a second line and giving him Kuzmenko as a winger is going to do anything.
What's the plus EV of upgrading on Nils Åman, right? Like, the plus EV is upgrading on Pugh Suter and having Pugh Suter be the Åman upgrade.
Going down
and paternal, right?
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think Henrique's, like, perfect to log minutes.
Yeah.
And the Canucks don't need a guy to log minutes necessarily.
I think they need a game changer.
They need a guy to give them an extra gear. I agree. I'm going to go with the right Anaheim Ducks target. Trevor Zegras.
Oh.
Trevor Zegras. What do you mean bad?
No, he's not bad. It's a bad pick, though.
What do you mean
it's a bad pick? You say your pick, and then I'll explain it.
He's 22. He's signed for the next 3 years at $5.75 million. You want to win a cup? You want to beat McDavid? You want to beat Jack Eichel? You want to be the best team in hockey? You got to get some hits. Players like Trevor Zegras aren't available unless there's some reasons for Jamie to be shaking his head and saying bad pick, right? There are some reasons to not love this deal, but he's 22. He's driven play at the ages of like 19, 20, 21. He's been super productive at the ages of 19, 20, 21 in the NHL. There's some concerns about him, but you know who else had concerns at the age of 22? Elias Pettersson. Like, Trevor Zegras at the end of the day is not Elias Pettersson. I want to be clear here. But he's skilled to the point where he has a real shot at being special. This is the guy worth paying a premium for. He exactly dovetails with Thatcher Demko's deal. You get three kicks at the can, and there's a chance if he becomes the guy I think he can be, especially under Rick Tocchet, who's had a lot of success leveling up, you know, some players who maybe have a tendency to pull the rope in not the wrong direction, but just not quite the right direction, like 10 degrees off, right? If he can level up and be that, there's a chance that the Canucks could have the best 1-2-3 center punch in the league. That's the sort of thing that wins you a cup. Trevor Zegras.
Okay. If you told me they were doing this at the draft, I'm interested. I don't think, and I love Rick Tocchet. You know I love the job he's done. But if you're saying we're going to give Rick Tocchet Trevor Zegras with a full training camp and a full season to get everything aligned and make sure he's good to go by that playoff run in the following season, okay, I can talk myself into it. You're bringing him in now, and you're replacing Andre Kuzmenko likely in the lineup, and you're expecting him to be a Rick Tocchet-type player, Rick Tocchet to be on board of his game, Zegras to be on board.
And get healthy.
In 6 weeks, ready to hit the ground running in the playoffs, I think that's too big a risk. I think that's too big a risk on the opportunity you have this year that it's not going to work out. If you're saying you have, you know, a full summer and training camp, then I'm on board. Doing it in season, this close to the playoffs, I just think there's way too much risk there.
At the end of the day, though, like, he'd be replacing Kuzmenko. Like, the risk isn't...
Yeah, but you want to improve.
No, I'm just saying, your downside risk for the rest of the season is you've still probably improved, assuming he's healthy, right? Because you have to see the medicals. But you've still probably improved on one-dimensional offensive forward if that's all he does. But I think he can do more right away.
But I guess the question for me is, are you going to spend big assets for a guy that Rick Tocchet's not going to trust to play more than 10 minutes in a game? Because that's 100% in the cards if you go out and get Zegers before these playoffs. That he's playing 9 minutes in a playoff game.
I'd rather, though, they go get a guy who might only play 9 minutes but has a real shot at making an impact in those 9 minutes.
I just think the opportunity cost is too great. Because you're spending your ability to make a big swing on that player with that much risk when you could do other things for guys with much, much higher certainty.
You don't win big if you don't take a risk. Like, I'm trying to find the Canucks' answer to Jack Eichel. I'm not trying to find,
no, I get it.
You know, the Canucks' answer to Derek Waugh the way you are.
Do it in the summer, uh-huh. And I'm on board.
Do it right now.
Does he go by Derek Waugh? I thought it was Derek Roy. Yeah, I think it's Derek Roy.
Well, he's a pirate either way. I'll just take Elias Lindholm next. Perfect fit from my
pick.
What, steal? You were just going to take the most obvious rentals?
Yeah, of course, yes.
And you're going to lose the creativity score when we present our dishes to the chop judges. All right, I'm going. I'm going with my guy, Elias Lindholm, right-handed. Pitching on the power play, pitching on the PK, wins 56% of draws as a righty. Hard to find a better fit, even if I'm not like absolutely in love with the ceiling there.
I am going to go with we're getting down to there's not a lot of high profile names on the market here. I'll go with Ilya Lyubushkin. Can always use another right shot defenseman, physical, big. Why not?
Yuck.
I like it. I'm gonna go way off the board here.
Let's do it.
No Reason to Believe is available. Let's go get Yanni Gourde from Seattle.
That's a good one. Oh, actually, hold on. I changed my last pick to Jordan Eberle.
You're going to steal Yanni Gourde from me.
I changed it to Jordan Eberle.
I love the Eberle fit, by the way. That's a good one.
Yep. Gourde, 2 years left, I think.
Yep. Yeah, Gourde's perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Gourde rules.
He would be awesome. As you said, we haven't heard his name out there, but you never know. Why not? All right, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. We're back on Monday. It's the bye week. So tune in just to see what we'll talk about with no Canucks games on the schedule. Have a great weekend. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.